11. Black Sands Beach is only 10 minutes from San Francisco. It depends where you leave from, of course, but from anywhere near the Golden Gate Bridge, it's 10 minutes, maybe 15, which is weird considering how raw and remote-seeming the place is. Exotic, even, its sand actually black, about 500 yards of it, from one bracketing cliff rock to the other. On the bridge, Toph is making cow sounds at the people walking because it brings us both to tears. He is leaning out his window, mooing. Moo. He has the window all the way down. Moo. The tourists are not hearing, it doesn't seem, because the wind coming over the bridge from the Pacific is wicked and relentless, as it always is, and the tourists, couples and families, all underdressed in t-shirts and shorts, are being abused by the gusts, are barely staying upright. Moo. Toph's not even trying to make it sound cow-like. He's just saying the word. It's just the person saying moo. He does a few where he kind of barks it, angry-like, but in monotone. Moo! Moo! It's hard to convey why this is funny. Maybe this isn't funny, but we're dying. I can barely see. It's killing us. I try to drive straight, wiping my eyes. Wispy clouds hurtle over us, cotton pulled apart by children. For the last group of tourists, he does a little stutter thing with the mooing.
I say,
he says.
I say.
He pauses for a second, then does a quick, then,
moo.
The bridge ends, the torn cotton clouds breaking up immediately. Then it's clear, Easter blue, and we're on 101, but just for a second. Two exits and then we get off at Alexander, then come back under 101 and up the Headlands Drive. As we climb with the road, right away above the Golden Gate, the clouds are suddenly below us, rolling through the bridge, fleece pulled through a harp. We did not go to the test. An hour ago, we skipped the city's mandatory high school test, the one Toph had to take if he sought admission to Lowell, San Francisco's vaunted public high school. A week ago, we had gone to the school administration building, a white colossus on Van Ness, to sign him up. I know we're late, but we're hoping to sign up for the test.
Who are you?
Said the woman behind the counter.
I'm his brother, his guardian.
You have guardianship papers?
Guardianship papers?
Yes, something proving that you're his guardian.
No, I never got any papers.
They needed something.
Like what?
Like guardianship papers.
There's no such thing as guardianship papers.
I was guessing. The woman sighed.
Well, how do we know you're his guardian?
I tried to explain, but had nowhere to start. I just am. How can I prove this?
Do you have a will?
What?
A will.
A will?
Yes, a will.
Oh, Jesus, this is incredible.
I thought of the will. Beth had the will.
The will doesn't stipulate anything.
I lied again. The problem with the will was that in the will, I wasn't even listed as the guardian. Beth was.
It was a technicality, something we had all decided on that winter. Beth and Bill would be the executors, be listed officially, and I wouldn't have to be involved in the money, the paperwork. This had come up before, the guardianship thing, the proof. Where is the proof? And always I had been afraid of being found out. All this time, a fraud.
Well, without guardianship papers, or a will, we can't do anything.
I had brought all his school records, school notices to parents, letters proving our residency, both of our names above the address.
We are a team. We have been a couple for years. The woman was unimpressed.
Why would I lie about this?
Listen, a lot of people from out of town want their kids to go to Lowell.
Are you kidding me? I'd come down here and pretend my parents were dead to get him signed up for a goddamn test?
Another sigh.
Listen, she said.
How do we know they're even dead?
Oh, God, because I'm standing here saying so?
Do you have death certificates?
This is disgusting, I said.
No, I said.
Another lie.
Any notices, obituaries?
You want me to bring you an obituary?
Yeah, that would work, I think. Wait a second. She turned around and conferred with a man behind a desk.
She turned back to us.
Yeah, that would work. Bring an obituary.
But I won't have time.
For both of them.
Always proving this. Always reminded. Never more than a few words into conversations, arguments, this fucking story.
That's why I lie, make things up. Why at this point, when making appointments with the dentist, whoever, I just call him my son, as cruel as it feels coming out.
I called Beth from a payphone. We only had 20 minutes until the office closed. Beth drove down with both the obituaries, little paragraphs about each of our parents and the Lake Forester, and the will, with 2 minutes to spare, and we placed them on the counter on top of Toph's birth certificate. And now, a week later, on the day of the test, as hundreds of kids are scribbling graphite into meaningless ovals, we're driving through the headlands on the way to the beach. It was only a few seconds ago that we actually realized that we were missing it.
Oh, Jesus, I said.
What?
He said. The test.
He put his hand over his mouth, expecting me to turn the car around, scramble like we always scramble, think of excuses. He was so used to it by now, the rushing, me banging the steering wheel in traffic, swearing at the windshield, the knocking on windows when doors were locked, the exceptions begged.
Forget it, I said.
Doesn't matter now.
It doesn't.
We're leaving. 2 days ago, we decided that we're not staying in San Francisco, and so we won't be applying to Lowell, won't be needing that school, anything here, because we're leaving the city, leaving the state. In August, we'll get up and fly out of California, and we'll go back, actually farther, over Chicago, and to New York. We're leaving again. Amid all the tongue-clicking and head-shaking, we have to leave, even though we'll see a little less of Bill and Beth. We'll move again. I think it's good to move around, see stuff. Not get stuck, Toph says. And I love him for saying that. He knew I needed him to say something like that, and there isn't a chance in the world I'll ask him if he means it. San Francisco is getting small, and everyone is dying. The summers are getting colder, and the falls aren't what they used to be. The kids in the Haight are younger all the time, more of them than before, sitting all day, all night at Haight and Masonic, with the sticks, the hacky sacks, nowhere to go in those stupid floppy reggae hats. And the drive to work was getting unbearable, the repetition too sad, especially at night, when after putting Toph to bed, locking the door, I would go back to the office. The drive just harrowing, the routine. I had even changed routes, had started driving down Geary all the way down, past the prostitutes, a change of pace, and it was diverting for a week or so, all the cars slowing down, stopping, the cops hunting, laughing. But then, even that was a routine. And so we have to leave, because the people are pissing on the streets during the day now. Any place, all the time, people are pissing on the streets, defecating on Market Street at noon. And I'm getting sick of the hills, always the hills, the turning of wheels to park, and the street cleaning, and those fucking buses attached to the ropes or wires or whatever, always breaking down, those motherfucking drivers getting out and yanking on that rope, the stupid buses just sitting there, in the way, everything just sitting there, stuck in the way. Everything weirder, the extremes more pronounced. The contrast's too strong. Toph and I keep going up the hill because you have to go up to get to Black Sands. First, straight up the hill, the road winding in and out past all the tourists stop for the view, looking down on the Golden Gate, and every time we double back toward the bridge, the view, biblical, presents itself. The view where one sees Treasure Island and Alcatraz, then left to right, all of Richmond, El Cerrito, Berkeley, and Oakland, and then the Bay Bridge, then the white, jagged seashells of downtown, the Golden Gate, blood red, then the rest of the city, the Presidio, the avenues. But we keep going, and as the road continues, winding up, the cars thin out, and at the very top of the hill, mountain, there are only a few sightseers left, and they are turning around to go back down, three-point turning right at that World War II-era tunnel at the top, because it certainly seems like the road ends right there at the top of the hill. But then the road continues, and there is a gate, a flimsy metal gate right there, and it is open. It's probably always open. We keep going, not slowing, and as Toph and I continue through the parking area and descend through the gate, two young tourists, Dutch fellows with the customary dark socks and shorts, are gawking, not knowing what we're doing. We are some kind of fantastic superhero team in a space-age vehicle, not bound by laws of country or physics. The road, now a one-way, heads straight for the water, and it looks for about 20 yards like we're going to go straight over. It really does for a few seconds there. And if we did, we would be ready, of course. We'd do the thing where we get out of the car at the same time, one door each, then the timed perfect dives. So we go slow. Then the road starts bending right, and then down, and in a second we're driving parallel to the water, a few hundred feet up, of course, for a while without even a visible cliffside to the left, just a sheer drop. And then suddenly we see the headlands whole, green and mohair hills, ochre velour, the sleeping lions, the lighthouse far to the left. Unbelievable, given we're 10 minutes from the city. This vast, bumpy land could be Ireland or Scotland or the Falklands or wherever. And we snake down, with the road bending back and forth along the cliffside, and Toph, as always, keeping his eyes away from the edge, understandable, not appreciating when I drive no-handed, using only my knees, for a little while.
Looky here, ha-ha, look at this.
Don't, asshole.
What?
Use your hands. You can't call me that.
Fine, a-hole.
And as distressing as this, his first curse is, the first I've heard at least, it's also kind of thrilling. Wonderfully so. To hear anger from him is a great relief. I had worried about his lack of anger, had worried that he and I had been too harmonious, that I hadn't given him enough friction. He needed friction, I had begun insisting to myself. After all the years of normalcy and coddling, it was time to give the boy something to be pissed about. How else would he succeed? Where would he find his motivation if not from the desire to tread over me? Always there had been just mutual devotion and compliance, and his kind eyes and young, pure wisdom. But now this, I'm an asshole. Such a relief. A breakthrough. The truth, finally clear and unavoidable. I should have noticed the signs earlier. While wrestling lately on the floor, and that one time on the tennis court when I gave him the wedgie, did he not fight back with more conviction than ever before? Did he not achieve a nice, effective sort of headlock and hold it with startling tenacity for much longer than comfortable? Did his body not tense up, his grip tighten, his eyes have in them a certain abandon, betray some rage from some distant place? Yes, yes, now we are omnipotent. Finally. You can't say a-hole either.
Okay.
A-hole's even worse. Fine, dickhead.
Dickhead's fine.
At Might, there had been an endless succession of fruitless lunches with various people who Lance had found, people with money who expressed some interest in helping us. It was always someone in their early 30s who, for whatever reason, had come into enough wealth to spread it around.
All right, Lance would say, his hands as parentheses. This girl is heir to the double-stick masking tape fortune, and she... Or, okay, this guy cashed out of Microsoft and has about 300 mil he's putting into Progressive Media.
We would meet them for drinks or lunch in the back of Infusion 555 or at a picnic table in South Park, and we would talk, explaining our plans, vaguely conveying our hopes, doing the best we could to articulate the fact that we wanted to be successful without being seen as successful. Wanted to keep doing what we were doing, with the option of opting out if we ever got bored. Wanted to conquer the world in a way that no one would be able to tell that that's what we wanted. Try not to let on how tired we all were, how unsure we were that we really wanted to do any of this anymore, actually. And midway through the meetings, the prospective benefactor would, as she or he pushed the ice around with their straw, explain how they'd have to talk anything over with their parents or their lawyers and advisors, and it was just as well. We hated the meetings. Hated each other half the time. Hated coming in every day. Wondered why we were still doing this stuff. We had been given a month's notice on our lease. We'd already been extending our stay, every month begging for one more, asserting that we were so close to getting some kind of funding that we needed some money so we could arrange for a place to move to first, or maybe we'd move in with whatever company agreed to help us out. So Lance went to New York as a last-ditch thing, meeting with people much too small and much too big to help. He called back every day with news of no news. He was staying with Sky, just as we all did when we were all in New York. We had a big party out there, and Sky organized the whole thing. Free drinks, a DJ, and had slept at her boyfriend's so we could all stay on her floor, four of us in her bedroom, sleeping bags and throw pillows, and at the party, when the police had come to shut it down, it was Sky and her mom, of all people, in town from Nebraska, who had begged the police to let us go on because her mom said, "These are just good kids, and they've worked so hard for this." Something to that effect. Sky, sad-eyed, batting her lashes, and the police let us go on. Lance called from Sky's the day he was supposed to come back because he was staying an extra day. Sky was sick, was in the hospital with a fever, food poisoning maybe.
"A viral thing," he said.
Moody and I met with the founders of Wired, went in to pitch the notion of their taking us under their wing, the perfectness of us with them despite how many times we had made fun of their magazine. We expected the meeting to be casual, easy, short on details and long on broad strokes. And of course, we were wrong. We were woefully unprepared. What we wanted was just enough money to get this next one out, and some kind of office arrangement, a corner of their floor maybe,
We had a few weeks to get out of our place. Anywhere would do, really. They wanted numbers and plans. Sitting around their gleaming black table, we fumbled and joked and did our best to sound confident, ambitious still, disguising our exhaustion, gesturing to each other. No, you go ahead, finish. No, you were saying? And we said that yes, of course, there will be a new design team and better proofreading, and yes, we would stop making fun of advertisers, and that yes, we are in it for the duration, that our projections this and our plans that, and TV shows and a website, of course, and some concessions on the covers, some familiar faces maybe, celebrities even, if they're the right kind, done the right way. Sure, some profiles, we'll tinker to make the thing available to a broader audience, operate with a small staff, same as always, we'll stay here, move in with you guys, or move to New York, whichever, it'll be so great. After handshakes, we walked out. Past all the workstations, the rows and rows, the heat of all the computers operating at once, the tangles of wires, past the kitchenette and the reception area, painted neon orange, the girl at the desk dressed just so, and in the elevator down to 3rd Street, we recapped. You think it went well? Yeah, yeah, they love us. But we both knew it was over. And the great, oddly wonderful thing was that neither of us really cared anymore. We cared, yes, but we were ready. I wanted it to be over, and Moody did even more so, and Marnie was more than tired of it all. Paul, too. Zev and Lance were still pushing to continue, still felt there was reason, but they also knew. We had long prepared them, that the floor could give out any day, that the floor had been built to give way. And so there we were, knowing that 3, 4 years, all these hundreds of thousands of hours, were going to end without our having saved anyone. What was conquered? Who was changed? With no spot on the space shuttle, that all this... What had it all been? It had been something to do, some small, small point to make, and the point was made, in a small way, and so fine. Moody and I walked through South Park on a flawless July day, the park full of new people, all of them beautiful and brilliant and young, and we were tired, and walked through them and back to the office. It was fine. Finally, the strange comfort of knowing the end, its parameters and terms. We had 2 weeks to finish the now final issue before we had to be out of the office, so we took the stuff we had already planned, cover story, are black people cooler than white people, and added, throughout, countless references to the end of the magazine, to death, to defeat. The first page essay. Death, like so many great movies, is sad. The young fancy themselves immune to death, and why shouldn't they? At times, life can seem endless, filled with belly laughs and butterflies, passion and joy, and good cold beer. Of course, with age comes the solemn understanding that forever is but a word. Seasons change, love withers, the good die young. These are hard truths, painful truths, inescapable, but, we are told, necessary. Winter begets spring. Night ushers in the dawn, and loss sows the seeds of renewal. It is, of course, easy to say these things, just as it is easy to, say, watch a lot of television. But, easy or not, we rely on such sentiment. To do otherwise would be to jump without hope into a black and endless abyss, falling through an all-enveloping void for all eternity. Really, what's to gain from saying that the night only grows darker and that hope lies crushed under the jackboots of the wicked? What answers do we have when we arrive at the irreducible realization that there is no salvation in life, that sooner or later, despite our best hopes and most ardent dreams, no matter how good our deeds and truest virtues, no matter how much we work toward our varied ideals of immortality, inevitably the seas will boil, evil will run roughshod over the earth, and the planet will be left a playground in ruins, fit only for cockroaches and vermin. There is a saying favored by clergymen and aging ballplayers. Pray for rain. But why pray for rain when it's raining hot, poisoned, blood? And then a few days later, we looked again at it. Hoped it didn't sound glib, callous. Zev wrote it, and he was still so young. Because Lance had just come back from New York, from all the running around, he and Sky, looking for money, any sign at all. We wanted to know how everything went. It was all academic by now, but we were curious anyway, morbidly maybe. Wanted to hear funny rejection stories, tales of indifference. And I don't remember why we were all there in the office all at once in the middle of the day, but Lance came in and dropped his backpack on his chair and sat down, slumped in his chair. Then he stood up. He paced for a minute. He stood by the filing cabinet next to Marnie's desk. He had a look on his face, an almost smiling look, his mouth sort of smiling but also kind of quivering,
his eyes focusing on something small on the floor between us. He had his hand in front of his mouth to hide whatever his mouth was doing. Was he smiling? He was smiling. His head was tilted. Something was funny. This was going to be good.
Sky died.
What? Someone said.
She died,
he said. What do you mean?
Who?
We were all talking at him.
She died.
Who?
Sky.
No.
Fuck you, dickhead. Why is that funny?
He's serious. Are you serious?
That's not funny. No, listen. She died. She died.
No. What does that mean?
How? It was a virus and it attacked her heart. She was there just for a few days. They couldn't...
No.
Holy shit.
Jesus.
No.
Marnie and I drove out, just over the Golden Gate, not far from where you have to turn up to get to Black Sands, to get a picture for the last issue's last page. We wanted something that would articulate everything, one image, and had chosen the tunnel on Route 1 that leads to Sausalito, carved through the Mohair headlands. It was a simple tunnel, a half circle, dark, its end not visible, with the entrance framed by a thin rainbow painted on long ago. We had parked and then walked along the highway, and Marnie had watched for cars while I stood in the highway's middle lane and took the picture, which in the end didn't really come out all that great. The rainbow faded and unclear, the tunnel not dark enough. But that was it, the final image. It was either that or the letter Paul had opened a few days before as we were already packing up from Ed McMahon in large, bold black type. Might Magazine has definitely won from $1 million to $11 million cash. We dedicated the issue to her, to Sky, of course, our sad little gesture. Man, we said, you should have seen Sky. Actually, you still can. Go rent that movie, Dangerous Minds. She's there, walking around, talking. She didn't write the line, she said, and was probably only 19 or 20 at the time, but there she is, forever, walking and talking, snapping gum. Oh, she was something. The walk down to Black Sands is long, steep, but the view, all wildflowers and ocean, is astounding. As Toph and I stomp down, men are coming up in pairs, sweating, stopping to rest. The walk up is 1,000 times what it is going down. As we walk down together, I become conscious of our proximity, mine and Toph's, and am preoccupied with making sure no one gets the wrong idea. He's almost as tall as me now and has that boy toy look that, with us together, at this beach in particular, could easily be taken as a Nambla kind of thing. And if the wrong person saw us, surely they would report us, and then the child welfare people would come, and then he'd be in a foster home, and I'd have to bust him out. We'd be fugitives, underground, and the food would be terrible. It feels like some place very far away, this beach. The patrons of Black Sands are primarily naked gay men, some straight naked men, some straight naked women, with the rest a mixture of clothed people like us, and the occasional Chinese fishermen. We drop our stuff in the middle, where the families, when they dare come down, set up and sit. We take off our shoes and shirts, scan the beach left and right. Toph has an idea.
You know what I think?
Yes. No.
I think everyone should be able, just once, to make an inanimate object come to life and be his pal.
I have to pause. Should he be encouraged? Like what? I ask, nervously.
Like an orange.
He scratches his chin, something he actually does when thinking these kinds of thoughts.
Or a hammer.
John was slithering, crawling, breaking up. He was in rehab, then left, and for a while he was living in Santa Cruz with a woman, 45 at least, who he met in N.A. I had stopped keeping track, did not ask why he was in N.A. in the first place, was not aware that he had a problem that would necessitate N.A. It was accelerating with him. He was trying to do all the problems he could do in the shortest possible amount of time. I wondered if that was the plan, some sort of experiment or performance art. If it was, I would have respected that. That would have been cool, but it was not, actually, that way, that calculated. We went to see a counselor. I brought him in after a while, talking to us. She called me an enabler. And so we left that counselor, and he slept on the couch, and then he was better. He would disappear for weeks, then resurface, calling from a library, from Oregon, had run through everything he had inherited, now needed $200 for the room he'd been living in, the red roof people were losing their fucking shit, and then finally, after getting punched in the head one night at the covered wagon by a guy he knew, he wanted to go back into rehab. Meredith and I split the cost of a private place, 3 weeks' worth, because he had no insurance and would not go into the county one. If he had to go into the county one, he might do something. He would not be able to handle that kind of shit, man. And so a few days before the private place, I picked him up from someplace in the Oakland Hills, the house of another woman he was seeing, two kids in the window. Dude, thank you so much for putting up the money. I really want to tell you how much I appreciate that. It makes all the difference in the world. The county place was full of druggies and hookers. I could not handle that, I swear. Would not have made it. I opened the window. I have nothing to say to him. There's a part of me, I say, that wants to let you out of the car right now, on the fucking bridge. A minute or so of silence. I turned up the radio. Then let me out. I want to let you out, asshole. Then let me out. I mean, are you trying to break some record? Like, right now, you're sitting here, seemingly normal, with your hands in your lap and everything, but then when do you put on the freak suit? When does that happen? I mean, he is rhythmically clicking and unclicking the knob of the glove compartment. Don't! He stops. I mean, why can't you just fucking, I want to say, chill, but that would sound wrong. Chill! Why can't you just fucking chill? He's with the glove compartment again. Stop it. He stops. I mean, all this is getting so fucking boring. It's really fucking boring. For a little while, it was kind of fun having you do all this made-for-TV shit, but not anymore. It's been boring for a while now. Sorry, dude. Sorry I bore you. You do. All this unbelievable whining, uncertainty, the wallowing. Please, look who's talking. You're one to talk about dwelling on this shit. Your family shit? You're the one who... We're not talking about me. Yes, we are. Of course we are. We always are. In one way or another, we always are. Isn't that obvious? Listen, fuck you. I didn't need to come out here. Then you shouldn't have. I'm gonna toss you out that fucking window. Then do it. Do it. I should. I mean, how much do you really care about me? Outside of my usefulness as some kind of cautionary tale, a stand-in for someone else, for your dad? For these people who disappoint you? You are so like him. Fuck you. I am not him. But you are. Let me out. No. I'm not this. I can't be reduced to this. You did it yourself. I am more than this. Are you? I cannot be used to get back at your dad. Your dad is not a lesson. I am not a lesson. You are not a teacher. You wanted this. You wanted the attention. Whatever. I'm just another one of the people whose tragedies you felt fit into the overall message. You don't really care so much about the people who just get along and do fine, do you? Those people don't make it into the story, do they? There's a truck next to us. Three kids in the bed. It will roll. All to help make some point. I mean, isn't it odd that someone like Shalini, for example, who really wasn't one of your closest friends, is suddenly this major presence? And why? Because your other friends had the misfortune not to be misfortunate? The only people who get speaking parts are those whose lives are grabbed by chaos. I am allowed. No. I am allowed. No. And poor Tove? I wonder how much say he had in this whole process. You'll claim that he had full approval, thought it was great, hilarious, etc. And maybe he did. But how happy do you think he is about all this? It's disgusting, the whole enterprise. It's too big for you to understand. You know nothing about us. Oh, God. It's enlightenment, inspiration, proof. No, you know what it is? It's entertainment. If you back up far enough, it all becomes a sort of show. You grew up with comforts, without danger, and now you have to seek it out, manufacture it, or worse, use the misfortunes of friends and acquaintances to add drama to your own life. But see, you cannot move real people around like this, twist their arms and legs, position them, dress them, make them talk. I am allowed. You're not. I am owed. You're not. See, you're just not. You're like a cannibal or something. Don't you see how this is just flesh-eating? You're making lampshades from human skin. Oh, Jesus. Let me out. I can't let you out here. Let me out. I'll walk. And I don't want to be your fuel, your food. I would do it for you. Right. I would feed myself to you. I don't want you to feed yourself to me. And I don't want to devour you. I don't want to use you as fuel. I don't want anything from you. You think that because you had things taken from you, that you can just take and take everything? But you know, not everyone wants to eat each other all the time. Not everyone wants to... We are all feeding from each other all the time, every day. No. Yes, that's what we do as people. For you, it's all blood and revenge. But you know, there is more or less, or rather less, to all this than that. Not everyone is so angry and so desperate and hungry. You can have me.
Ick, no. I'll make you stronger. I'm done with you. You are not. You will be back. You will always need. You'll always need someone to bleed on. You're incomplete, John. You just missed the exit.
Shalini's party was huge. It had been a year since her fall, and she was out of the hospital, had gone home to L.A. to live with her mom and sister. She was improving daily, could do just about everything again, though her short-term memory was still jumbled, unreliable. Everything from a year ago forward was gone. She could often not remember what had happened the day before, the hour before. She had to be told about the accident almost daily, and each and every time the story was told, she was floored. "Wow," she would say, as if the story were not about her at all. But her memory, she was working on it, had flashcards, had a tutor, a diary where she kept notes, the events of the day, a paper memory of things that had happened. She had come so far, and the prognosis was good, so for her 26th birthday, her family had planned a huge party at their house, all kinds of food, a DJ, dancing, torches around the pool, 100 people, more. Toph and I drove down. I didn't know what to bring as a present, so did what I had been doing regularly at that point. I asked Toph to make her something. He had been making a series of Jesus figurines from colored bakeable clay. Jesus in a tuxedo and cane, mouth open. Show tunes Jesus. Jesus with a blonde wig and a pink woman suit. Hillary Jesus. And Jesus in a white sleeping bag with a red cross atop it. Sleepover Jesus. Complete with a tiny can of itching powder. They were dead-on renderings and were always appreciated by the recipients, but he claimed he didn't have any time to make things for my friends. And my second idea was shot when he refused to give up the Book of Mormon he had ordered through a 1-800 number. Well, when we got to L.A., I dropped him off with Bill in Manhattan Beach and drove on to Shalini's, stopping at the mall on the way where I bought a cat calendar, a book about menudo, some paperweights, $54 for a few seconds of laughs. I found her house, high on a hill, on a wide, dark street. There were cars everywhere, both sides of the road. I had to park blocks away. You could hear the music from 500 yards, could see the lights in the backyard. I was terrified. I hadn't seen Shal in months, did not know what to expect. I knocked on the huge door, and when I was let in, there were people everywhere. Presents stacked on the table, on the floor, huge, beautiful presents. There were people in the living room and the family room and back there in the dining room, a whole crowd doing something, and then maybe 50 more in the back on the patio, around the pool, surrounded by torches, the backyard bathed in fiery light. Her mother said Shalini was upstairs, resting. I walked up the carpeted stairs and followed the voices down the hallway. In a bedroom overlooking the pool, there she was, sitting on her bed, looking bright and sparkly, completely the same.
"Hello, darling," she said.
We hugged. She was dressed up, a silk blouse, a miniskirt. I told her about how my car broke down on the way to L.A. It had. How I borrowed and drove Bill's to her house. How great the party seemed to be going. All the torches in the backyard, all the people, the pool. She looked out her window, down at the pool, glowing like a sky, the people silhouetted against it.
"Yeah, but what's it all for?" she asked.
She didn't know why everyone was here. You could see her searching her memory for a reason, finding nothing. "It's your birthday," I said. Her sister, Anuja, and I explained the birthday party.
"But why the big deal? I mean, I know I'm pretty popular and everything, but really?"
She laughed a little laugh. Anuja and I sketched it out as vaguely as possible, mentioned a fall and a coma, an incredible recovery, and as always, when we were done with the story, Shalini was utterly amazed.
"That is incredible," she said.
"Yeah," we said. "You were lucky." No one mentions her friend who died, the one she came with.
"I mean, thank you, God,"
she said in her valley way, rolling her eyes. God sounded like God. Eventually, she came downstairs, and she danced for a while on the parquet floor they'd assembled by the pool. They did the presents, and there was a dinner, and Carla and Mark were there, and everyone else from all those hospital days. The view and the warm winds coming up from the ocean made it as euphoric as it was meant to be. People walked around with tears in their eyes, especially Shalini's mother, who I had seen no other way for as long as I had known her. As things wound down and Shalini was upstairs resting, I walked with her mother to the door. "You know, I went looking for the landlord," I said.
"What do you mean?"
"The landlord, the one who owned the building?" I tell her how I followed the trial in the papers, the trial of the landlord responsible for the faulty deck, how I went to the courthouse half a dozen times, looking for him, wanting to sit in on the hearings, wanting to see the man. I planned what I would do to him if given a moment alone, that if I found myself in a dark, vacant place with him, I would shove my fist through his head.
Did you see the trial?
She asked. No, I kept going to the wrong room, or they would have rescheduled it. They were always rescheduling it. I kept sitting in empty courtrooms, waiting. Tell Shal I had to take off. I left knowing that I might not be back. I said I would be back, maybe next Thanksgiving, but I knew that we were leaving California, Toph and I. We were exhausted and felt hunted. Everyone else was leaving or was gone. Flag had moved to New York for grad school, then Moody moved there for a job, and then Zev and Kirsten went to Harvard with her new boyfriend. He was in law school. She was after an MBA. A nice couple, an untroubled couple. And I surprised myself by being endlessly happy for her. And we're going too, because going to work every day is starting to tear me into little pieces, that stupid drive every day, the same roads, hills, and because I still don't have health insurance, and we're sick of that tiny, loud apartment and living next to all those horrible people who don't understand, who should be like us and understand, but they don't yet understand anything at all. And I'm tired of living across from that senior citizen's home, having to wake up and see them puttering on their porches, getting dressed up to walk down to the community center to put on their rubber caps and swim so slowly in that pool. There are too many stupid echoes here, everywhere. Even a beach like Black Sands brings her back. How in her last half year she would watch from the car. At Toph's flag football games, Beth and I would sit on the sidelines, cheering, making unkind remarks about the coach, while she stayed in the car, parked in the lot high above the field. We could see her, leaning over the steering wheel, squinting to see the action. We would wave. Hi, Mom. She would wave back. She couldn't make the walk down to the field, couldn't make the trip down to the beach the last time we were out here, when Beth graduated and I flew out, when after the ceremony, she, Beth, and Toph and I drove down the coast, through Monterey, and when we got to the beach in Carmel, we told her we'd be back, and ran down the high dune, ran down to the water, Toph only 7 then, his first time in California. Beth and I pretended that we were throwing him in the ocean. We hit each other with long stretches of brown, rubbery seaweed. We looked up at the car, and we waved. She waved back, high above the beach, overlooking. And after we rolled around more and poured sand on Toph's hair and made Beth kiss a dead jellyfish, we walked back up knowing our mother had seen everything, was so proud of us all, watching from above. But when we climbed the dune and were closer to the car, it almost looked like she was asleep. She was asleep, her hands in her lap. She had not waved. So today, the wind is perfect. There's hardly any at all. This beach, Black Sands, usually has some kind of wind coming from the water, which fucks things up, sending the frisbee deep into that frigid water, forcing me to wade in my shorts, stiff leg, to retrieve it. But today, there is no wind, and there is almost no one else here, which means we have most of the beach, or at least our part of it, to ourselves, which is really something, even if for an hour. We've gotten so much better. I mean, we started out really good when he was smaller, when we first came out here. He was years ahead of anyone his age, would dominate games of Ultimate at his summer camp. They worshipped him, the other kids. You should have seen the younger kids crowd around him. Oh, and when he would take off his baseball hat and let his long, blonde hair fall forward. This one time, a boy was awestruck. You shouldn't wear a hat, he said. Your hair is amazing. This little boy. I was right there. It was Parents' Day. But so, throwing-wise, Toph didn't used to have the range he does now. And the tricks, he can do tricks. And I've always had the tricks I can do, like the one where I run up to the frisbee as it's coming at about chest level, and when I'm almost there, I jump at it, do kind of a 180 in the air. It's probably a 360, actually, when you think of it, because I... Yeah, so I spin around in midair, coming at the frisbee as it's coming toward me, and when I'm perfectly... When I have my back to the frisbee in mid-spin, that's when I catch it. So it's like a behind-the-back catch in midair, but ideally, with the spinning and all, I land, get this, facing Toph. A 360. That's a pretty cool trick when you can get it to work, which is only so often for me, even though I'm really fucking good. So the point is that Toph does that one now, and he's way more consistently good at it than I am. He still fucks it up a lot of the time, bats a frisbee away, which makes me cringe because we break our frisbees every couple months. And it's always something like that, a batting of the frisbee that cracks the thing right in half, always happens right when we get to the beach or wherever. It's thick plastic too, of course. We only use the really heavy frisbees.
And so he does that trick, which is a cool one to watch, but he also does, almost prefers all these stupid tricks. Really stupid fucking tricks. Tricks that aren't really tricks at all. They're just stupid things, because he's always been more interested in doing goofy, stupid shit than doing things normally, keeping score, that sort of thing. So he's got one trick where, when the Frisbee's coming, he'll just lay down on his stomach for as long as he can, and then, at the last possible moment, he'll stand up and then take a few steps and go catch the Frisbee. That's it. It's a pretty stupid fucking trick, right? I mean, it makes no sense at all when you think about it. It's the most unspectacular thing in the world, but he cracks himself up with that one, truly, laughing like an idiot. The morphine was taking her under, but her breathing was still strong. It was erratic, but you should have heard the breathing. When it came, it was strong, forceful. It was a yanking of air. Her limbs weren't moving anymore. Now she was still, her head back, and just the breathing, like a sort of uneven snoring. More and more like snoring, the grinding, the gasping. We stayed up all day and night because you did not know. We moved chairs close, curled in them, and slept, held her hand, and soon the tide came in. It started with a different sound in the snoring, something rounder, more liquid, then almost a gurgling. Her breaths became more strained, pulling both air and also these bubbles. What was that sound? And Beth and I were there, on either side, and the breaths were pulling, yanking at something like a boat still tied to a dock, the motor revving, but something holding, holding. The breaths were pulling more and more, and the gurgling, the bubbles, became more prominent in the breathing. She was pulling at a tub of water or fluid, then a lake, a sea, an ocean, pulling at it. The fluid kept coming. The tide inside her rising, rising, her breath shorter, like someone being filled as the water climbs and there is no longer anywhere to... But there was intelligence in that breathing, and passion in that breathing. Everything there. We could take that breathing and hold its hand, sit on its lap while watching TV. The breaths were quicker and shorter and quicker and shorter and then shallow, shallow. And that's when I loved her as much as any other time, when I knew her... as I thought I knew her. Oh, she was out. She was gone. A week into the morphine, maybe, and she could go any minute. Her systems were falling apart or gone. No one had any idea what was keeping her going, but she was sucking in that air. She was breathing so erratically, weakly, but she was doing it so desperately. Each breath taking all that she had, her small person, with her beautiful tanned skin, shiny. Beth and I draped over her, not knowing when. But she would... just breathe and breathe, suddenly, anxiously, unyielding. And I only hope it wasn't regret, that there wasn't regret there, in those breaths, though I know there was. A dream there was, when I hear the breaths. I could hear the anger. She could not fucking believe this was actually happening. Even while sleeping under the morphine and when we were only waiting, expecting, she would snap back, would rise suddenly and say something, cry out, a nightmare. Furious about this bullshit, that something like this was actually happening, that she was leaving all of us? Toph? She was not ready, not even close, was not resolved, resigned, was not ready. And while we're throwing, there's a naked man walking. I first see him as he walks right past me, between me and the water. He's about my height, skinny, pale, bony butt, and he walks past me, down the shore, toward Toph. At first, I'm worried about Toph having to see this man, not just his butt, but his whole frontal action happening, this man walking toward Toph, unabashed, proud even. And for a while, for 50 yards at least, as he approaches, I watch Toph, watch him to see if he looks, or laughs, or is disgusted at this human nakedness, all pale and unadorned, pathetic and silly and maybe desperate, maybe needing something, needing to be looked at by strangers. And God knows what kind of freaky looks the naked guy will be giving him, the kinds of freaky looks naked guys are always giving. But then I'm watching Toph's face, and he doesn't even look at the man. He does his best to avoid him, over-concentrating on his throws, looking serious, like this throw is so insurmountably important that he could never be bothered by this naked man. It's funny, actually. Impressive, really. And then the man has passed him, is gone, walking on toward the end of the shore, toward that spooky cliff jutting into the breaking waves. And Toph will never have to see the naked man again. And we will be ready. At the end of every day, we'll be ready. We'll not say no to anything. We'll try to stay awake while everyone is sleeping. We'll not sleep. We'll make the shoes with the elves. We'll breathe deeply all the time. Breathe in all the air full of glass and nails and blood. We'll breathe it and drink it.
so rich. So when it comes, we will not be angry. We'll be content, tired enough to go, gratefully. We'll shake hands with everyone. Bye-bye. And then pack a bag, some snacks, and go to the volcano. Toph does another trick where, okay, first I throw the frisbee to him and he catches it normally, and then, while he's standing there, he just slowly and methodically puts the frisbee in his mouth, like a dog. And then, once he's got it in his mouth, he does a little jump. Like, that's how he caught it. Catch, put in mouth, then little hop. It's hardly even funny, that one. It's just, sorry, it's so dumb. And he does it in front of other people, which is the tragic thing. He thinks people will laugh, which is just so... He laughs, of course, loves it, but he still can't do... I'm not even sure he's tried it. My big trick, the one where I cartwheel and catch the frisbee with one hand while I'm upside down, that's a great trick, a crowd pleaser, but he hasn't tried it, and I'm not sure why. But he throws well, and you have to throw well to make the cartwheel trick work, and you have to throw it low, 2 or 3 feet off the ground, and not too fast, and not too floaty, just a nice, even throw. And it has to go to my right, because I can't do the trick going to my left. So even though he can't do the trick, he's essential to my doing it, because he's the only one who can throw it the right way, consistently, which is okay for now, but he'll do it soon enough. He's doing everything earlier than I ever did. Beats me in every sport. Basketball, I cannot get a shot off anymore. They come back in my face, and he revels, he yells in triumph. He's already almost my height, is 6 inches taller than I was at his age, will surpass me within the year. It's never too gusty on this beach. It's just balmy, the air waving around, loopy and soft, which makes you wonder why anyone ever goes to Ocean Beach, which is always insanely windy, pointless for anything. And you can't swim there either, and the wind just destroys any kind of throw you want to do unless you're just standing next to each other and dinking it back and forth like a couple of pussies. To throw and have it be any fun, we need some calm, because we need to wing that fucker. And of course, people stop and watch us. We're so fucking good. People young and old, whole families, gather to ooh and ah, thousands of people. They brought picnics, binoculars. Not like we're frisbee geeks. We don't wear fucking headbands or anything. We're just good, so good. We throw it high and far. We just get as far apart as we think we can get. And so we sent flowers, and Lance, who was always closest to her, wanted to go out for the funeral, but just came back from New York. And so we sent a wreath from all of us and never had to see her embalmed and cold. Could just think of... And everything that seemed possible at 24, 25 is now just such a joke, such a ridiculous fiction. Every birthday an atrocity. And we now keep that gold tin on the kitchen counter, and inside are my father's business cards and a tiny sweater my mother knitted for a teddy bear and some change and some pens and a cap to something, maybe a camera lens that we haven't been able to match with his mother and... Oh, fuck, I was gonna say. So Toast got this other trick where he catches it normally. I'll throw it straight to him, a totally regular throw, and after he catches it, he'll take a few steps forward and do a little roll, a somersault, with the frisbee on his head like he caught it mid-roll or something. You should see him now. He's so tall all of a sudden. He'll be some kind of giant. 7, 8, 9 feet tall. Surely the tallest guy in our family. Ever. Always. We're best at the long high throws. Like when you take 4 or 5 steps and rip it. It's almost like a shot put approach. The steps. 4 or 5 quick. One over the other. Kind of sideways like. And then you slash away with that fucker. It's such a violent act, throwing that white thing, you're first cradling it to your breast, and then you whip that fucker as hard as you possibly can while keeping it level, keeping it straight. But otherwise, with everything you can send it with, you whip that fucker like it had blades on it, and you wanted it to cut straight through the paper blue sky like a screen, rip through it and have it be blood and black space beyond. I'm not gonna fix you, John, or any of you people. I tried about 1,000,000 times to fix you, but it was so wrong for me to want to save you because I only wanted to eat you to make me stronger. I only wanted to devour all of you. I was a cancer. Oh, but I do this for you. Don't you see? I do this for you. I have done this all for you. I pretend that I do not, but I do. I eat you to save you. I drink you to make you new. I gorge myself on all of you, and I stand, dripping, with fists, with heaving shoulders. I will look stupid. I will crawl, drenched in blood and shit. I will. Oh, look at those birds on their stiff, tiny legs, and there is nowhere I stop and you begin. I am exhausted. I stand before you millions. 47,000,054,32, whatever. You know what I mean? You people? And where is my lattice? I am not sure you are my lattice. Sometimes I know you are there, and other times you are not there. And sometimes when I'm in the shower with my hands scratching around in my head, I think of you all your millions of heads and legs standing under buildings, shuffling them around, carrying them, taking them apart, making new buildings. And I am with you there when you're under that fucking building all centipede-y and everything, you motherfuckers.
And when Tove catches his, he flexes with a fury, his muscles just these taut strings, his mouth open, teeth straight, and pushing so hard against each other. And when I catch, I do it too. I flex and yell and vibrate. Can you see this? Goddamn, look at that fucking throw. Did you see Tove throw that goddamn thing? The trajectory on that fucking thing? It's going way past me, but I can run under it. I am barefoot and run like an Indian, and I can look back and it's still coming. I can see Tove in the distance, blonde and perfect. It's up there and rising. Jesus fucking Christ, it's small, but then it stops up there. It slows and stops all the way up there at the very top for a second, blotting out the sun. And then its heart breaks and it falls. And it's coming down, and the sky is all white with the sun, and the frisbee's white too, but I can see the thing. I can see that fucker. I can make it out, and I can run under it. I know where that fucking thing is. I will run under and outrun that fucker and be under it, and will be there to watch it float so slowly down, spinning, floating down. I beat you, motherfucker, and I am there as it drifts down and into my hands spread out, thumbs as wings, because I am there, ready to cradle it as it spins just for a second until it stops. I am there. I was there. Don't you know that I am connected to you? Don't you know that I am trying to pump blood to you, that this is for you, that I hate you people, so many of you motherfuckers. When you sleep, I want you never to wake up. So many of you, I want you to just fucking sleep it away, because I only want you to run under with me on this sand like Indians. If you're gonna fucking sleep all day, fuck you motherfuckers. When you're all sleeping, so many sleeping, I am somewhere on some stupid rickety scaffolding, and I'm trying to get your stupid fucking attention. I've been trying to show you this. Just been trying to show you this. What the fuck does it take to show you motherfuckers? What does it fucking take? What do you want? How much do you want? Because I am willing, and I'll stand before you, and I'll raise my arms and give you my chest and throat and weight. And I've been so old for so long. For you, I want it fast and right through me. I'll do it. Do it, you motherfuckers. Do it, you fuckers. Finally.